We're going to talk about estate planning for Christians in particular. Estate planning principles, of course, are applicable to all people, whether you're Christians or not, because the principles are so closely related to the tax structure of the federal government and also of various states. And so when we talk about estate planning for Christians, it's really basically estate planning for people. And added to that are certain kinds of agreements that Christians often want to enter into, which makes a difference, such as charitable remainder trusts in lifetime or charitable remainder trusts in will, called testamentary trusts. But actually, we should realize that this first session, that this is not a one-session event, but it's a five-session event from Monday to Friday. And so we hope that during these five sessions, we will be able to share enough information that will make it easier for you to make decisions within your own family about your own estate in relationship to each other, if you're a living husband and wife, or in relationship to your children, if you have living heirs, or in relationship to the charitable organizations which are dear to your heart. And those organizations which you wish to support in lifetime or at your demise, all of these factors have tax consequences. Your choices are not always equal. Doing this may mean a great shrinkage in your estate. Doing that may be a very minimal shrinkage in your estate. So what is very necessary in order to make estate planning related decisions is that you have enough information. However, information isn't enough either, because we very often fail to act on information, and we fail to make decisions on the basis of information because we have an attitude which doesn't allow us to make a decision. So these are interrelated, because if you are very clear about what is of primary importance in your life and what is of secondary importance, then it becomes easier to make decisions which relate to your convictions, and relate to your Christian faith, relate to the love within your family, rather than just on the basis of tax factors alone. You should not plan your estate division simply to arrive at the least possible tax, because then you are really a slave, because what you want to do is to achieve the fulfillment of your life between husband and wife and between parents and children. And so this is paramount. And so attitudes have a lot to do with our decisions. And so we're going to talk somewhat about attitudes this week. And we're going to try to achieve a positive attitude, a willingness to review the aim of one's life, of your life, the willingness to articulate these things, to talk about them, husband and wife, even to fight about them. It's better to fight than to ignore the issues. And sometimes some wonderful things happen when husband and wife begin to talk about what's important. What's number one objective? And it happens that a man who didn't talk very much all his life and was very tight-fisted, that when it comes down to the wire here of an argument or discussion about what to do the rest of our lives, that Harry Olson, or whatever his name was, though he was very tight-fisted, when he finds out that his wife never realized that he was doing this because he very deeply loved Olga. And he would never think of letting Olga be in a spot where she was not able to cope. And so all of this tight-fistedness has a very, very deep root in his eternal love toward his wife Olga, which she never knew. She just thought he was a tight-fisted guy. So sharing these things is very important to bring up to the surface what's important, and husband and wife talk about what we want to achieve with the rest of our lives. Talking about timeline objectives, what we want to achieve in the next 5 years, etc. We're going to talk about that in more detail later. And so we have to talk about a willingness to do these things, to bring these things up, a willingness to share, to talk, to disagree, to fight for what we think is important, to make concession to each other. And finally, of course, a willingness to stay at this process. It may take a week, it may take 2 years, but stay at the process of communication within the family until you arrive at a consensus which makes sense to both of you. And so this is attitudinal. There's a lot of an attitude of willingness to keep hang in there and to share and discuss is very important for the process of estate planning. Now, what about the cognitive factors, the things that we should know? What should we want to learn these 5 days in order to be better able to carry on this process of estate planning and making some decisions? Well, we're going to talk about the estate transfer methods and vehicles. How can you transfer a property in lifetime? You can do it by gift, you can do it by bargain sale, you can do it by a bona fide sale for actual market value. We have to know what the methods are. Some people enter into joint tenancy with right or survivorship titles with their children. This is generally not what they think it is, because it's a fully taxable event, either as a at the time of death, that is a taxable event, because a transfer takes place at that time from you to your son. And even though it's not a probate event, it's still a taxable event, and you must pay the same taxes in state, in most states, and to the federal government as if it were a transfer by will. There are some advantages, but to have a joint tenancy with right or survivorship titles between husband and wife with smaller estates is ideal. But if you have large estates, joint tenancy with right or survivorship is very bad. Because in that case, say a $500,000 estate, all in joint tenancy with right or survivorship, regardless of what you wrote in your will, all $500,000 would go to the surviving spouse. $250,000 would be exempt from federal taxes as a marital deduction. The other $250,000 would be taxed on. Then the surviving spouse would have a $500,000 estate. Then the surviving spouse dies, and she has to pay tax on a $500,000 estate. Well, that wouldn't be necessary. If Olga can't make it on $250,000 for the last 4 years of her life, there's usually something wrong, I would say. So it would be better for that estate not to have joint tenancy with right or survivorship, but have fee title. And then the husband could write a will in which $250,000 goes to Olga and the other $250,000 goes to the children. And there is a tax credit which will be equal to $175,000 by 1981, which means there'll be very little taxes at his death. And again, there'll be very little taxes at her death if she never got the whole estate. But if she gets the whole estate, there's going to be very heavy taxes at Olga's death, because there's no marital deduction for her, and the whole estate is taxable. This is a very common problem that people have. They have joint tenancy titles and thought they were poor. Now they've become rich. That's a quote-unquote sort of situation. Because of inflation, we've got all kinds of nightmarish possibilities in the future. Believe it or not, I was a millionaire twice, but not in the United States. I was a millionaire in China, because we had 100% inflation per month for a couple of years. You know, they were at war from 1937 onward with Japan, and they never quit until 1949. That's 12 years of war. You have 12 years of war, you're not raising enough taxes to carry on that war. And so they kept printing paper currency until it got to be worthless. And so, a millionaire, but so what? Now, we've started a process here in America. I hope it never gets to that. I hope they find some kind of a break somewhere that they can pull to keep it from being run away. But the principle is there, the possibility is there, that we will have runaway inflation. What is the rate of inflation since, geez, some of you were born in the teens, some in the 20s, I suppose, but what's the rate of inflation, say, since 1942, the beginning of World War II? When you think it's about 300%?
About
4%
a year.
4% a year?
Average.
Okay, anybody else disagree with him? 600%, that's getting close. I would say 1,000%. Okay, what did you pay for a house in the 30s and the early 40s? You could buy one for $4,000.
Mm-hmm.
What do you pay for a house now? You're lucky if you find a good house for $40,000 in any city. So there you are, 1,000%. So these are factors that we know, but we don't know what's going to happen in the future. So I suppose just generally we say you should know that there are risks involved. That's part of the cognitive process, to know that this is not a sure thing. There are risks involved in making decisions. You can split those risks somewhat by making a decision with half of your estate, which will be a hedge against inflation, and with the other half of your estate in retirement, which will increase your income. So that goes working it both ways. A hedge against inflation currently would seem to be to own a farm or a real estate in the city, because that absolutely keeps up with inflation. There's nothing, in fact, farmland has outrun general inflation in price. That would be a hedge against inflation, to own something that keeps up. A hedge against poverty of not having enough to live on, because sometimes these real estate doesn't produce the income that you need, would then be to do something else with the other half of your estate, which would increase your income. And that way we'd have kind of balance against one against the other. And if you have a contract which gives you a sure income, that would be a hedge against depression, where things that have a variable income could have a lower income. But if you have a fixed income, like with an annuity, it would be steady and solid. So an annuity would be a hedge against depression. Owning real estate would be a hedge against inflation. I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but we're just talking about some of the things that information to learn facts about, and we'll go into this more in detail. So we need to know something about the transfer methods that you can give property to your children by gift, up to $3,000 per donee per year without entailing any kind of federal gift tax. You can do this for the rest of your life to your son Jim or Jane, or if you have 10 children, to each of them, $3,000 per annum, as long as you can afford it. And there's no shrinkage of your estate from taxes, because there is no tax on this $3,000 per donee gift. I'm talking about federal law, not state law. We have other factors we want to talk about, and that is where there is a taxable income, where there is a taxable estate. What about liquidity factors? Is there enough? Are there enough liquid assets to pay the taxes? You really should have liquidity enough so that doesn't have to be a forced sale of some assets of the estate, which might have to be sold at a low price, because you have to raise the money to pay the taxes, or your executor has to raise the money to pay the taxes. If there's no liquidity in your estate, that's what he might have to do. He might quickly have to sell some property that should not really be sold. Now, we ought to know, and we're going to talk more particularly about charitable gifts, how they relate to your estate taxes, how they relate to your income taxes, how charitable remainder trusts that you can enter in with charitable organizations, how they give you a present income tax deduction, they give you income for lifetime, and they reduce your estate taxes. We're going to talk about that like on Thursday or Friday. We're going to talk about trusts with banks, trusts with charitable organizations. We're going to talk about wills and the factors that are important. And we'll take these bit by bit. They're all in the syllabus for the next 4 days, for the topics for discussion. Now, one of the factors is, like I said before, a very important factor is for husband and wife, having gained some knowledge about the results of their decisions, that they discuss at length until they come to an agreement, and then to take action. Taking action in the first level means to write a will. If you have never written a will, and you should die without one, it might not be too bad, because every state has laws of intestacy which protect the interests of the wife and children. And in the state where I come from, there would be a division of the state between wife and children if the husband were the first to die. If there was one child and one wife, I shouldn't have to say that, the division would be 50-50. If there was a wife and two children, the division would be one-third to the remaining spouse, one-third to each of the children. If there were four, five, six children, it would be one-third to the wife, and the five, six children would divide equally. That sounds not too bad, and it isn't too bad either. There's a little more expense involved because there's extra hearings or court orders or protection for minor children has to be established by the court and so on. So it does cost a little more if you don't have a will, because there are more fees. There's more administration costs, and that administration cost far exceeds the cost of meeting with your attorney to write your will. So it's more economical to meet with your attorney in a lifetime to write a good will than say, oh, I won't pay that attorney $50 for writing a will. I'll die without one. Well, you're just cutting off your nose to spite your face if you do that, because writing wills is much less expensive to your estate than to die without a will. We often think about will writing as something that's simply for older people. Not so. Young people should have wills too. So if you've got children without wills, and they have minor children, a little boy 2 or 3 years old, your son John needs a will, because he should protect that child by his will, to establish a trust fund for the support of that child. To establish who is going to be responsible for that child, who's going to be the legal guardian for that child. Because if you don't decide it, the courts have to decide it. Now, these are things that we should have to arrive at the point of being able to do something. We call that a skill. Ability to meet with your attorney and to outline what you want to happen and to get that will written. Charitable distribution can be made by will as well. And in larger estates, this can be a very big factor. I remember seeing, you don't have to believe this, but it's true. I can remember reading a will that a fine dear old Lutheran lady had, and she showed it to me. She was so proud of it. And she gave everything to her children with the request that they make gifts to charity. Now, what was she missing? She was missing the charitable deduction. If she had made these bequests to charity herself in her will, that would have been a non-taxable event. But if she gives it to her children, that's a fully taxable event, with the request that they make a gift to charity of their choice. Well, so you need to know, you need information, and you need a certain little bit of moxie, skill, if you would call it, in knowing what you're doing and how you're doing it. Now, where do people bog down? People often bog down at putting together an accurate inventory of their estates, of their holdings. Because if you want to put together an accurate inventory of what you own, you often have to dig back into ancient history, 30, 35 years ago, to find what the cost basis was of that stock you bought, or the house you bought, or the lots you bought. Because always you have to have not only a good description, identification of that bond or that stock or that real property, But it's very important that you establish what your cost basis was. And also on top of that, what improvements you have made to this property, which increases your cost basis. Because this is a very important factor in finding out what the tax consequences of that property will be. So you have to, the skill we are looking for before the week's over is to be able to list all holdings item by item which make up the personal estate together with history of the items showing date of acquisition, cost or value at time of acquisition, the kind of title under which it is held, whether it's a fee title, whether it's a joint tenancy title, or any other tenants in common title, etc. All these things have a tax consequence. It makes a difference how or who owns it and how it is held. So to use all of these factors in conjunction with the articulated objectives to formulate an estate plan that is viable for your estate, well, that's what we hope to achieve during this week. Now, if you turn the page on this, the outline I gave you. You will see that we already did something about what we have there for the first day, course orientation. We've been talking about that. We've been talking about the process of articulating life goals, of sharing, discussing, and reaching consensus in a family. Now we can talk about an overall goal of life, and that has something to do with our Christian commitment. We view the goal of our life to live under God's grace as responsible parents and stewards of the gifts of God, which include our children and all of our physical possessions. And so that, if that is your goal, your overall goal, and you and your wife agree to that, and you've been living that way, you are really enjoying a great blessing. Because in many families, there's this constant haying and hawing and bickering because they really are not agreed on what they're trying to do. There may be, however, a necessity to agree on some particulars. And we talked about that earlier when we talked about specific objectives on a timeline. Younger people usually have the objectives of buying a house, and they get started on that, and then before long a high priority will be education of children, and when that's accomplished, then often the timeline objectives relates to helping them get launched, if you have that capability. And I know some who launch their children and say, that's it, there is no inheritance. I've come across several like that, wealthy people. And I said, why? And the person said, the last one I talked to said, I wouldn't take the chance of ruining my children's life by giving them an inheritance. I give them an education, I give them a nest egg of $10,000, and I tell them, that's it. There is no inheritance. This is it. And so he said, if they knew that they were going to have $300,000 each down the line, they could hardly wait for me to die. It would ruin their life. It might make them lazy. It might make them irresponsible. It might attract the wrong women to their lives, their sons' lives, etc. So he said, when they're through college, that's it. That's absolutely it. And so this man and his wife were free to establish charitable remainder trusts. They entered into large agreements with their church body. It wasn't the American Lutheran Church. They entered into trust agreements involving like $500,000 to create an income for themselves in lifetime, in their retirement, and which would give them income tax deduction at this time, and then charitable distribution to various institutions under the umbrella of that organization, and that was a charitable distribution, ending up with no estate taxes to pay. So, well, that was their option. So objectives on a timeline. Then we get back to that subject. We took a little course off to the right here. And so now everybody's out of the house. Everybody is working. They haven't all achieved a high measure of success. Daughter Diane has got a husband that has problems, and your son John isn't really shaping up like he thought he would that fast. But at least you're now at the point where you're thinking about retirement. And so objectives on that timeline for the next 5 years would be to consolidate the assets and to make plans of how to use them for retirement income and so on. And then, of course, there'd be another bend in the river of life would have to do, well, what happens when one of us dies, you know? And so you have estate planning on a timeline. You have objectives you want to achieve at that point when the Lord calls one of us home and the other one's alone. So we can think in terms of that, objectives on a timeline as you go ahead. And like I said earlier, the necessity of discussion, necessity of sharing differing opinions, differing attitudes, and trying to understand each other more fully, and to make the measure of concession that's necessary to make in order to reach a consensus. Because you want to act together. You certainly don't want a state plan to split you apart. You want it to bring you together. And it very often results that way, that husband and wife have a deeper appreciation of the concern and Christian love and conjugal love that is our lives. And so don't feel that everything's coming apart because you have an argument. And you look old enough here as though you've already had 100 of them. And you've coped with that, right? You've survived. You've grown. And you hug each other a little tighter after you settled an argument. Okay, that's basically what we just wanted to do the first day, was to have an overview and to kind of articulate the objectives. I want to make a distribution of a... Yes, we do. Certainly. Okay. Here, would you pass this on? This is a worksheet that talking of... You want to pass these out, please? This is a worksheet just... you don't have to use it like it is there, but discovering and articulating objectives. Income, housing, education, investments, and so on, for yourself and your spouse. If you've got it all done in your mind, and you know what you agree on, you don't have to look at this paper. But if you haven't ever started doing anything like this, and you figure you've got 15 years left, or 25, or 40 years left in your life, you should start thinking in terms of objectives on a timeline, what you want to achieve by when, in the next 5 years, and so on. Now, getting back to the little, I can't really tell jokes very well, but it came close to being a joke, I think. And that is the idea of objectives on a timeline in order to make kind of compromise between husband and wife. If your wife is a spendthrift, what are you going to do about it? You haven't done anything about it the whole life. You've been arguing with her all the time. She spends and you save. Okay, maybe if you had something in your plan that would add to the quality of life, she'd cooperate with you. Maybe your wife is an inquisitive sort of person who likes to travel. Do you think if you'd have an objective that once every 10 years or once every 15 years you take a vacation overseas, you think she'd save? I'll bet she would. But if you don't give her anything, she's going to spend everything. So I think there has to be some concession. If you're security, let your wife be quality. Put it on the timeline. Give her something worthwhile. Or vice versa. Sometimes the man who is a spender, the woman's a saver. I just had to take one or the other. It works both ways. But the whole idea there of having objectives to improve the quality of your life on a timeline will often bring the cooperation that's necessary between husband and wife. Now, questions. We are running out of time. According to our schedule, we run until when? Till 10:15?
Right.
Okay, we got still 20 minutes to discuss. First of all, tell me where I'm wrong. Yes, please.
If one of the couples died, and there are several children left, would you work through it in the same way with concessions and consensus within? There will be different levels of estates there.
All right. That's a very good question. I'm going to say yes, you should have a variation according to the needs of your children. I'll remember you. Are you related to her?
No, I was going to say, if you'll talk loud enough or repeat it so it gets on the tape.
Yes. You mean it's not getting on the tape now?
Well, it comes from the audience.
Oh, I see. The class. Oh, I see. The question was, when writing a will, whether you should reach consensus with your children about the division of the estate. And my answer to that is, generally, yes, it would be good, because I think the children should understand something about why you're doing what you're doing. Now, let me illustrate with an example from life. I remember working with a family which had three sons and one daughter. They were not a wealthy family. He had a filling station with a few bulk trucks to deliver oil to some farmers in his community. He had some parts store. We get some parts for their tractors or their bus cars and so on. But he had an indebtedness too. He didn't even have his business clear. The whole business was probably worth about $95,000, but he had an indebtedness of around $35,000. And it seemed rather strange because he's doing a good business. Well, he had three sons, and they had all just finished their schooling, and they all went to graduate school and got their doctor's degrees. One was a physician, one was an engineer, and one was an attorney. And they had one daughter, age 16, mentally retarded. Now, we're talking about estate planning for that family. Do you think if he died intestate and let everything happen as the laws of the state, would that be right? No, it wouldn't. So he said, I'm through with my sons. Bless them. I love them. But I worked hard and I mortgaged my business and everything for them to achieve this. I'm through. There's nothing in my will for those three sons. They've had it. Everything that we own will be for remaining spouse and for a disadvantaged daughter. Does that answer your question? That's an easy one because it's so evident. But it illustrates the point that to have share and share alike wills is perhaps the most unequal thing that you could have. And when you have something different from share and share alike, I think it's good that you have a family council. You talk it over. And don't be afraid to preside as a queen of the house of this family or as a king of this family, because sometimes the strength of wise, authoritative decisions which reflect Christian love and family love is it doesn't have to be defended very much. It can be easily understood. And I believe that it helps the whole relationship of the family if everybody knows what the score is. All right.
If you're bound to have one of your children as the executor.
Well, that is a question. It's hard to answer because, first of all, the executor should have the capability of doing the job. Secondly, he should be a trustworthy person. If your son is capable and if he's trustworthy, then why not? The executor should, in some states, require them to be resident of the state. Other states do not require that, but that you'd have to find out for your own, from your own state laws. In any case, the executor needs legal counsel, and so he doesn't have to be absolutely, you know, a whiz in everything in order to be an executor, because he's going to have legal counsel to rely on. There are some states now that have informal probate, where the executor carries on almost everything himself without legal aid. And some states, Minnesota and Wisconsin are among them, and I understand there's quite a few Minnesota people here, where the requirements are simply to file reports. And the clerk of the court receives these reports. And I believe a judge has to pass on them as being adequate, and that's about it. And where the estate is fairly simple and is not too large, many are using the informal probate instead of the formal probate. In that case, you might still be required by various states to have your reports that would be filed to be examined by an attorney. I'm not sure because, you know, I can't keep up on 50 states' laws. I don't try to, only federal. And so, yeah. It really doesn't depend upon the genes and the blood so much as it depends upon whether what kind of persons they are, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, and in case of the first step, you think in terms of your spouse being the executor, right? Why not? Now, there's something else that was in the back of my mind here that I want to say about wills. Oh, yes. Writing of wills. Do not think that one will is enough. Mr. Olson, Mrs. Olson needs a will just as much as you do. One of the reasons why you need a will, each needs his own will, is that according to the laws of intestacy, dying without a will, most states give collateral heirs of the remaining spouse all of the property. Say, Mr. Schmidt married Jeanette way back when. He brought in all of the wealth to this family, but Jeanette, of course, was a faithful wife and a great life. Mr. Schmidt wrote a will, everything to his wife, but his wife never wrote a will. Says Henry, or I forgot, Henry Schmidt. Henry takes care of everything, you know. So she never wrote a will. Then she died without a will. What happens to the estate? Do Henry's brothers get anything? No. It's all to the heirs of the remaining spouse. So her sister gets the whole estate, whereas actually his father is old and long-lived person, but poverty-stricken. He wouldn't get one cent. You understand what I'm saying? The same thing when you have joint tenancy with right of survivorship titles. Many people say, well, we don't need wills because we got joint tenancy. And when one of us dies, it goes to the other. Right. But what if the other dies within 6 months without writing a will? Aha. Again, it would go to her collateral heirs, her sisters, her nieces, or what? And if she doesn't have sisters, she only has nieces and nephews and cousins, then the state tax is usually very, very heavy on distant relatives or nuns. Yeah, on distant relatives. Huh? And some strange things happen. We had an attorney, no, with our office received a letter from way out here in the West Coast saying, I received $25,000 as an heir of such and such a state, there must be a mistake. I don't have any uncle. I don't have any relatives by that name. And here it turned out to be a second cousin, see? And a person died in Minnesota with no close relatives, only second cousins. And about half the estate was eaten up in research, you know, and in other expenses. And then there was a division made to second cousins who didn't even know anything. Now, that probably was a copping out on Christian stewardship, don't you think? The man who died without a will? Don't you think you think he was a good Christian steward? Even, I mean, from a standpoint of within his own family, I think he copped out, really. He should have written a will. I suppose I should add one statement here before I forget it. And that is, I am not an attorney. I am not licensed to give legal advice in any state of the Union, certainly not in the state of Washington. I am merely sharing information. So anything I've said this morning has only the value of information. It is not legal advice. So much for the record. They say it's necessary for us to make this statement because somebody might say that I gave legal advice. I'll deny it. I deny it right now. I'm only giving information.
Well, you're taxed only on your equity, aren't you? If you have debt, you're not debt. That would be part of your estate, the debt part?
That's right. There are certain deductions from your estate. And it seems to me that I brought a little reference book here this morning that tells us exactly what that is. But generally, I take it off the top of my head. What is non-taxable in your state? Well, the administrative expenses, your last illness and burial and these things, and your indebtedness, yeah, that's all subtracted from your gross estate until you arrive at your net estate. And then your net estate is your taxable estate. But then there are some exemptions and deductions. Various states have various exemptions and deductions. But the federal government now allows a marital deduction, that is a surviving spouse, of $250,000 or 50% of the estate, whichever is greater. And that is then not taxed. So that reduces the amount of the estate that is taxable. But the amount of your estate that is taxable for federal purposes and for state purposes are not the same. There is some variation because the exemptions for state in various states are they're variable, to say the least. I mean, there's no consistency from one state to the other. But almost all states, I believe, have some kind of exemption for remaining spouse. There's also in the federal law now an exemption for orphans, where you have minor children who are orphaned by the death of parents. A relationship to the years from present age to 21. And so, I mean, the younger there are, the greater the exemption. Something goes to them without tax. And as they get older, it's less and less and less. That's by formula. Okay, any other questions?
Is it advisable to have an attorney draw up your will, or can you do it yourself?
Legally, you can do it yourself in most states because some states allow a will which is a spoken will and witnessed by two people to be a valid will. But then those two people have to make a record of it, you know, to file it. But so off the top of the head, you could say, and quite correctly say, yes, you can write your own will. Is it advisable to write your own will? No. It's not advisable, because the chances are that there'll be some contradiction or something that is not in conformity with state law. And therefore, the cousin who didn't get one cent will contest that will, or more likely yet, if one of your children receives very little, we'll probably get an attorney and say, well, okay, let's break that will. So chances are they can because of some technicality. What if you have only one witness and you should have had three? What if your witness is signed not at the time when you signed the will, but after the fact? They read it and then they signed it. That in many states would be not a legal witness, because a legal witness would require that the witnesses to your signature be present when you made that signature, and that they witness it on that very date, and they make their signatures at that same time, same place, same date. And failing that, you see, the whole thing could be broken. So don't be penny wise. By all means, at home, talk over and agree on what you want to do, and have this outline ready. Then go to your attorney to write a will, and if you've done something really foolish tax-wise, he probably let you know, and you make some adjustment. But simply from the standpoint of technical structure, that it conform with law, yeah, you should see an attorney. The fees for writing wills are variable, extremely variable. And but a general rule of thumb would be somewhere between $25 and $100 for writing a will. There are exceptions. There are some attorneys who charge very little for writing a will, simply because they feel that if they write the will, their firm will probably ask to be legal counsel for the executor down the road a ways. And so our daughter, who is and faculty at Luther College, Decorah, Iowa, and her husband took a trip to Taiwan and Hong Kong this summer. And they have no children. They've just been married 2 years. But they wrote a will before they went on that trip. And their attorney charged them only $15 for two wills. That's ridiculous. And it wasn't a formula will either. I mean, but that's exceptional. I think you should be prepared to pay somewhere $25, $50 per will and not say he's exorbitant. Look, he has a secretarial staff. He has an office. This has to be typed. It has to be without an error. Maybe that typist has to type it three times because of an error. There can be no erasures or anything like that. It's going to be a clean document, right? So even just from the standpoint of his secretarial staff and his office expenses, you know, you can't be too chintzy about that. So don't feel he's robbing you if he charges you $50 to write a will. No. Then you have a counseling session with him, right? First. And then you come back to his office for signing and for witnesses. Some of his staff probably be his witnesses. So don't be too chintzy about it. I meet people who say, I would give my attorney $50.
Do the witnesses have to know what the contents of the will is?
Absolutely not. They only have to be a witness to that signature, to this document. They don't need to know anything at all.
It's also kept on file then in the attorney's office, isn't it?
Yeah, you should. There should be multiple copies, one signed copy and a number of unsigned copies for reference. And if you want to share information with your children so everybody knows what the score is, well, have a couple extra Xerox copies and distribute to them so they know what the score is. And another thing is, wills are changeable, they're irrevocable. So you can tear up your will and write a new one. So it's not a last word, it's the word for now. It's your decision according to present circumstances. If the tax structure changed a lot and your will was out of date and wasn't wise for the new tax law, you should tear it up and do it over. If you become extremely wealthy or extremely poor, it might make a big difference and you should write a new will. Yes?
That brings up the point in our case. We have wills that we wrote, I think, 10 years, or had written 10 years ago. And thinking about it, I think they're worthless now because our situation is entirely different.
Time to tear it up and write a new one. Right. If there are new heirs, that's another reason for writing a will. Right? Say, our time is up, and...
There's one more question.
Yes.
This lady's leaving.
Okay, if anybody who's leaving, there's a priority, high priority.
Could you write a written amendment to a will that you already have?
Yes, that's called a codicil. But if you add a codicil to your will, you must have the same kind of signature and witnesses and dating as if it were a whole new will. You can't just add it on. But that has to be witnessed, just like a whole will. And then it must also be not... I mean, it must be clear so that there's no ambiguity. So if it contradicts something in the will, it must be very clear, you know, that that article is out. This is it. All right.
Is it necessary to get a special type of attorney that's more knowledgeable, or can the general small-town attorney handle a will?
A general small-town attorney can handle a will, right.
Yeah.
If you want to create a trust in will, you might go to someone with that has a little more experience, right?
Okay.
If you want to create trusts in your will, then you better get the expertise.
Thank you.
We'll see you all tomorrow morning, except those who are leaving. It's good to meet you.
Thank you.